From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We have a great show planned for you tonight. Everyone knows Robin Sachs. She's a semi-regular guest on the program. She's a former ADA out of Los Angeles County. She's a current legal correspondent for the Young Turks on Current TV and, of course, a legal correspondent at MyFox LA. Also, Joel Brodsky. He's also attorney in the Chicago area, well-known for his work in the Drew Peterson case. And what I thought I would do is bring them both on tonight to talk about O.J. Simpson and his recent claim of ineffective counsel. We all know our friend O.J. is spending some lengthy prison time for kidnapping, robbery, whatever it is, and he's gone back to court asking for a new trial because he says his lawyer, Yale Galanter, was ineffective. So welcome back to the show, Robin and Joel Brodsky. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Robin, how are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Thank you for having us.
Now, you know, it's Father's Day was the other day, and let the audience know, after I'm done with Joel and Robin, I've got the author of a new book, and I didn't time this right, maybe, called Killer Dads, The Twisted Drives That Compel Fathers to Murder Their Own Kids. So just in time for Father's Day, I thought I'd bring the author of that book on. And anyway, I don't know what I'm doing. Joel, what have you been up to lately? Let's talk a little bit about what Drew Peterson's new attorney is saying about you.
Well, what have I been up to? Well, we had a hearing on that, and the motion for ineffective assistance was denied. The judge found that there was no ineffective assistance, and I'm just doing what I normally do, is defending people into trying cases and staying busy and out of trouble.
Robin, what does this mean, ineffective assistance? You know, we hear about it all the time. The pundits on TV, like yourself, talk about it. What does it mean to the normal Joe out there that's listening?
Well, ineffective assistance of counsel is the great catch-all for an appellate issue after you've been convicted, usually after you've been convicted of a crime. That's one of the first things an appellate lawyer is going to look at to be able to bring up the argument, basically saying your lawyer did something and screwed up. The thing is, and Joel knows, not only, I'm sure, from personal experience, and I too from personal experience, you expect that as a defense attorney in every single case after your client has been convicted to get some sort of ineffective assistance of counsel. I mean, it just kind of goes together with the conviction and the prison sentence like peas and carrots. Whether or not it's actually granted is a whole different story. As often as it's alleged, it's just as often almost, I'd say probably a good, I don't know the actual stats, but a high statistic of it not, a case not being overturned on ineffective assistance of counsel.
Joel, when you see O.J., and it was televised here a week or so ago, coming on, talking about his attorney, Yale Galanter, is no slouch. What about that claim? Was he just grasping at straws, or did he really have something there?
No, I watched it because I know Yale. Yale is one of the finest lawyers out there. I was just grasping at straws. They were getting absolutely ridiculous at times with some of the allegations they were making. For example, talking about, look at Yale had a financial motivation because he got paid $700,000. Lawyers get paid. Lawyers do have a financial, incentive in their cases because this is how they make how we make our living. This is how we get paid. So to say that you have a financial motivation because you get paid is just ridiculous. I think also, hello,
we might have lost.
Off there.
We might have lost Robin.
Hello?
I'm just going.
Hello?
I'm here. When are you still there? Okay, we're going to take a break. That's the wonders of live radio, and we'll be right back here. Is that what that was? Okay. So the NSA is following Scared Monkeys Radio tonight, and we look like Robin's number got dropped. No, no, I'm kidding. You're both there. Joel Brodsky, back to what you were saying.
Yeah, and that's, you know, so that's why I think that a lot of what they were saying was grasping at straws, you know, or to say that, you know, he took the case for the publicity. You know, Yale's very well known well before he started representing O.J., so they were really grasping at straws. But if I can get just and then Robin can comment on this. I think that the difference between what happened in O.J.'s case and what happened in my case, or in the Peterson case, was that they brought up in O.J.'s case the ineffective assistance on post-conviction. In other words, he's already run his regular appeal route, and they brought up, and that's very typical. That's when you usually see ineffective assistance arguments are on post-conviction after the full appeal, post-conviction proceedings after the full appeal process had run out. In the Peterson case, they brought it up right on direct, I mean, right in the motion for a new trial, which is really a bad idea, and the appellate courts have said this, because once you bring it up in direct appeal and you don't succeed, it's barred forever. You can't bring it up if you discover something later on in post-conviction, and it really limits your actions, your options later on, if in 20 years or 10 years or 5 years you find out that the government didn't disclose some evidence, or there was something out there that should have been discovered that wasn't. The appellate courts say, well, you can't bring that up now. You already had your bite at ineffective assistance argument, and it was denied. And that's where I think, Drew's case, they kind of jumped the gun. If they were going to bring up that argument, it should have waited for after his full regular appeal had run out. And I don't know if Robin agrees with me on that, but
Robin Saxon and Joel Brodsky are here.
It's inside baseball a little bit, but
what about
I totally agree. I totally agree with that. I mean, there's, you know, but that to me, you know, with all due respect to your former client, is, you know, him not having Drew Peterson not being able to be controlled in any way whatsoever and wanting to run his own show and deciding that he knew the law better than anybody else. I don't know if you would have gotten any lawyer could have helped him. You know, he needed to say that. You know, that was as clear as day.
What about that, Joel?
You're right. I mean, to say that it wasn't his fault, you know, it's somebody else's type of thing.
What about the publicity aspect, Joel Brodsky? You came on my show with Drew several times. You ran the publicity gamut. It seems like these high-profile cases do run the publicity gamut nowadays. What about that, and what about that in general when it comes to ineffective counsel?
Well, that's a good point. They did bring that up in the ineffectiveness in their argument, and Judge Bramilla specifically found that it's a sound strategy sometimes in a high publicity case to try to get out and get in front of the publicity, to get out. You know, it's not a mistake. It can actually be effective if you try to get out in front of the publicity. Now with Drew, and the way he came off on the camera, that didn't work. But it doesn't mean it's an unsound. Just because it doesn't work doesn't mean it's not a sound tactic.
Yeah.
And the judge specifically said that in his findings in denying the motion for a new trial based on ineffective assistance.
What about that, Robin? What about the publicity angle?
The only argument, I think I'm going to take a different approach here. I think that I don't think that there's anything ineffective assistance of counsel-wise in Drew's case, Joel representing Drew, that anything that smells of ineffective assistance of counsel at all whatsoever. And for the most part, I would say, and I agree, Yale Glancer is a fine lawyer. I don't believe he did this for publicity. God knows I don't think it helps his publicity in any way. But I think he got himself in a pickle, and I actually think that there is a plausible ineffective assistance of counsel argument, and it's limited. It's limited to that plea bargain issue. If there was a plea bargain that was communicated to Yale Glancer and it was not communicated to O.J. Simpson, that's a big problem. Now, of course, that means that we have to rely on O.J. Simpson's word that happened, except for the fact that it's not just O.J. Simpson's word. During the testimony, you also had the testimony of Gabriel Grasso, who is co-counsel, who's another officer of the court, who says that it went down that way. And that is potentially ineffective assistance of counsel, and that's a big oops, and I think that's the one area where the judge may find ineffective assistance of counsel to be there.
What about that, Joel?
Well, that is true. I mean, certainly I find it hard to believe that they made a bona fide offer that Yale wouldn't have run past his client. That's just something that, a lawyer doesn't do, a competent lawyer wouldn't do. If the judge did, in fact, find that there was a bona fide offer made and that wasn't communicated to the client for his consideration, that is a problem. Absolutely, and that could result in a new trial or a reversal, without doubt. I just can't believe that, they would make such a good offer. I mean, it was a pretty good offer from what I recall, and that O.J. wouldn't, and Gail wouldn't have gone to O.J. and said, gee, we really got to think hard about this offer because the case, they had a tape of, when you heard the tapes of O.J. screaming in the you don't move, don't move, right. Don't move, and there are people in there with guns. It's not a case that you want to, that you couldn't lose. It's not a dead bang winner. So if they made a good offer, I really find it hard to believe that the Yale Galanter would not have gone to O.J. and said, we have to really give this some thought.
Robin Saxon.
But if the judge finds that, then that is a grounds.
Robin Saxon, Joel Brodsky are here.
I could see the offer being made, actually. I don't think that it's funny how we look at this case. I mean, yes, you had him on tape, but, I think it was a messy case. The property was his. I mean, you did have, or at least was it at his time. I mean, yes, you always had the O.J. factor, and they're going to convict because it's O.J. that you had in the back pocket, no doubt about it. But I could also see that a scenario where O.J. from day one says, no way in hell am I ever taking any plea to anything other than probation or some sort of misdemeanor. There's no way I'm doing time. I got away with murder. Hell no. No one's going to convict me. This case is far worse than what that was. No one's going to convict me. I'm not going to take it. And then perhaps a specific offer was made and that wasn't communicated, and Yale may have, just assumed, there's all kinds of stuff that can happen that's not necessarily nefarious, but would potentially amount to ineffective assistance of counsel.
Joel, I do have a question, though. What about that O.J. factor? Now, you got to admit, Drew Peterson, not the most popular client I'm sure you've ever had, was convicted in the court of public opinion long before he went to trial. My experience with him on my show, probably three of the most popular, highest-rated programs I've ever done, but also three of the programs I got the most hate mail about. What about that O.J. factor? And I'll start with Joel and then go to Robin. When you have a client like that getting started,
it is rough. We had we thought was a great jury. Given the veneer that we had to pick out of, we thought we had a very good jury. Great mix of people. We picked them. The state allowed us to really control the deer, so the jury thought that we had picked them. But we turned out in the long run, when we really, after the trial, we sat back and analyzed it, and, we tried to even talk to a couple of jurors. This jury was just looking for anything that they could base a guilty on. Mm-hmm. They weren't trying to weigh the evidence. They were saying, give me enough to find them guilty. And I think that's what the quote-unquote O.J. factor is, where they're not really presuming innocence and trying to trying to weigh the evidence and see, well, did they really prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt? They're just saying, give me something, give me enough that I can convict this guy because I really want to convict him. And that's the what I'm sure the jury in the O.J. case that he's serving time for now, and that was the experience that we found with our jury in the in Peterson, and it's rough. I mean, when you have a jury like that, if there's any evidence that tends towards guilt, you're going to get a conviction.
But then again, Robin Sachs, we can talk about Casey Anthony.
Right, and that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, you have the O.J. factor, we have the Casey Anthony factor, you have the Drew Peterson factor. I mean, and right now we're sitting here getting ready to have the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman factor. You just don't know, what the mindset is. I mean, I think that part of the issue is, the prosecution bears the burden of proof. It is their burden to prove a defendant guilty on all elements of each and every count. And I think that what happens where these factors become problematic are prosecutors who drink too much of their own Kool-Aid, read too much of their own press, and feel overly confident about their case and sidestep steps. And I think that you saw in your case, the Peterson case, and you saw in Jody Arias, and what you didn't see in O.J., the murder trial, and in Casey Anthony's case, is those were prosecutors that just didn't put on all of their evidence. They left stones unturned, and that gave enough to the jury to find reasonable doubt.
Yeah, in Casey Anthony, they really didn't have any evidence about the mechanism of death, how the child died. And that was the big problem. And that is, they were relying on a circumstantial case. I think if that jury had one, and even in Casey Anthony, had one iota that their child, you know, died of, you know, was of a homicide, not an accident, they would have convicted her. The slightest evidence, you know, hearsay or otherwise, they would have convicted. They had that big hole, and the state didn't. Robin's right. The state did not try hard enough to plug that hole.
Well, Robin, with Trayvon Martin now, and actually I was going to spend the last 5 minutes on that with the two of you, if that's okay. With Trayvon Martin and what we're hearing as far as the jury selection goes, finding and maybe the term impartial isn't correct here, but finding a jury that hasn't heard something about this is probably going to be impossible.
Yeah.
It just may be, but there's no rule in court that says you can't know anything about the cases in terms of having heard about it or whatever. It's that you can't have formed an opinion about whether or not someone is guilty. And as a matter of fact, as you sit there and jury, you know, voir dire, if you had a vote at that exact moment, the judge will tell you, if you had a vote right now, how would you vote? Each and every person should vote not guilty because there's been no evidence that's been put on. And so if you, you know, hearing about it is nearly an impossibility in a case like that. But I think we as common folks spend too much energy worrying about that, whether you've heard about it. It's whether you're likely to have judged it, researched it, have an opinion on it, feel emphatic about it, or otherwise. That's what they need to really be concerned about.
But, Joel, isn't it almost impossible to say or to think that someone who has heard about something hasn't formed some opinion on it?
Well, they certainly can have some, you know, gut feeling about it, but to have actually, you know, reached the conclusion is what you don't want. You know, picking a jury is really like trying to read tea leaves. It's like it's trying to get to know somebody by asking them questions for 10 or 15 minutes, and it's hard to really to get to know somebody in a situation like that. I think in the Zimmerman case, Trayvon Martin case, I think a lot, because Zimmerman's going to have to take the stand. It's a self-defense case. And I think a lot is going to depend on how he does on the stand. If he does well on the stand and comes across as just a, you know, a guy who was, you know, was getting beat on, you know, but a concerned citizen, but not a racist, not an out-and-out, you know, bad person or aggressive person, then I think he'll be acquitted. It's going to come across to his demeanor and how well he does on the stand, and that's what's going to they're going to judge the case on. And as all self-defense cases go, the only person that really jury gets to hear is not, at least self-defense as far as homicide goes. They don't get to hear the dead person. They only get to hear the accused. And if the accused comes across well and has a good demeanor on the stand, you're going to get an acquittal. If the person comes across in a way that they don't like, then you have a problem. You're going to get a conviction.
What about that, Robin? What about not being able to hear the dead person? We even had the President of the United States comment on this case. It's going to be difficult not to at least think about that.
Well, again, I look at also just how the prosecutor also conducts themselves. I mean, I personally, as a prosecutor, was offended by the press conference that the DA's office had in Florida when they announced charges. I mean, you had the prosecutor who's, you know, has the political ambitions sitting there doing a press conference where she comes out and says, you know, I just came back from praying with the Martin family.
Jeez.
And now upon our return, we're here to seek justice and we're going for second-degree murder. I mean, you can be passionate about your case, but praying with the victim's family and announcing that in a press conference just felt inappropriate. And you have to, you want your prosecutor, more than your defense attorney, you want your prosecutor to be guided by what's right and what's ethical and not by the pressures of politics or people. Not to say that they shouldn't have charged him. I'm not saying that that's, you know, necessarily that he shouldn't have been charged. However, the way that she came off, if that type of demeanor is what we see in the courtroom, I think we may have a problem. And I think that the reason why this is kind of the same thing with Casey Anthony and, you know, in terms of Jose Baez and Juan Martinez and Jody Arias, I mean, these were very likable dudes, you know? These were very regular folks that people could relate to, and I think that that's what jurors want.
Joel, I'll give you the final word. What about Trayvon Martin, and what about O.J.? Will he win his appeal on ineffective counsel?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think, you know, in the long run, he got a great, he got a good trial. I mean, he got a fair trial. Galanter, Yale did a fine job, and he was convicted by, you know, convicted by an unbiased jury. So I don't think that that's going to happen. I just hope that in the Trayvon Martin case, that we don't end up with what happened in the Jody Arias case, where it gets so, it becomes entertainment to some extent, and you get people so involved that it's almost like a virtual lynch mob, where witnesses are afraid to take the stand and talk and testify on behalf of the defendant because they're worried about being physically attacked. We saw that in the Arias trial, and I'm just hoping that the judge and the prosecutor and the defense and everybody involved in that case can keep that from happening, because when you have this lynch mob, a virtual lynch mob, because it's on the internet, but lynch mob mentality, that defeats the whole purpose of courts of law and justice. And it's, I think that's probably that's the biggest threat that's coming by televising cases now, is that they're going from, you know, somebody's life being determined to daytime entertainment. Right. And we cannot allow that to happen.
Joel Brodsky, Robin Sachs, thank you.
Thank you. Nice talking with you.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Take care, guys.
Bye. That's Joel Brodsky and Robin Sachs. And, Joel had a client who is probably one of the most hated clients that has been around for a long time. What about O.J. and his ineffective counsel? The Yale Galanter is an attorney who you see on the talk shows. He's pompous. He's full of himself, but he's also a very good attorney. O.J., is that O.J. factor? Just because it was O.J., is that why he was convicted, or did they look at the evidence? Or you would hope that they looked at the evidence and not because it's just O.J. And, you know, when you're picking a jury, like in Trayvon Martin, are you able to find someone that knows about the case but hasn't formed an opinion? I'll let you form your own opinion about that. We're going to take a quick break here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. The last time I had Mary Papenfuss on, the author of the new book, Killer Dads, it hadn't been released yet. It's a book about the twisted drives that compel fathers to murder their own kids. And Killer Dads is now available at Amazon and other places. You can click on the link in the show notes. And I've also added a review of Killer Dads in the show notes that tells you a little bit more about the book from the people at Blog Critics. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the book. This isn't your, as the kids like to say, first rodeo when it comes to writing stories about crime.
Right, although I spent a lot of years at the New York City tabloids and at the New York Post and New York Daily News, so whenever it was a slow news day, there was plenty of crime to write about, particularly domestic violence, which I think was kind of the genesis of this book.
Now, it's interesting when you use the term tabloids. When we think about tabloids, we think about the Inquirer and the Star magazine and things like that. What about newspapers today? A lot of them are disappearing. Some of them are called tabloids. Some of them, it's all right and left now. It just doesn't seem like we can get the news from a straight source anymore.
I don't know. I disagree. I mean, I love newspapers. Sadly, they seem to be dying out. We have to go online, and now we have to depend a lot on, individual bloggers, and who knows what their agendas are But it's true. It's difficult to get. You just have to read a lot, I think, and think for yourself and balance what you read. And tabloids is actually a term that refers to the kind of paper it is rather than a broadsheet with a huge page. It's a smaller, sort of like a large book page. So technically that's a tabloid, although they got kind of a bad reputation because of some of the tabloids. I don't think the New York City papers are like that.
Mary Papafoose is here talking about her new book, Killer Dads. Let's take you back to 2004. You're covering the Scott Peterson trial for the New York Daily News. And that kind of gave you the inspiration to write this book. In fact, one of the chapters in the book, Mask, talks about Lacey Peterson. Let's go back to 2004.
Right. I was covering for the Daily News, and I determined for myself pretty early on that Scott Peterson was guilty. I think a lot of people felt that way. And sitting in that courtroom every day, I thought, this guy's going to end up in San Quentin, which he did, and he's never going to have another child. And he killed his 8-month pregnant wife. And I just couldn't get over that. I thought, what brings a man to this, to kill his only offspring or offspring-to-be? And I wondered if it was something in society. Was there something about American life, something we do to people? Was it something in Scott Peterson? Is there, are some men hardwired to not care about their kids? So it kept running around in my brain until I had to write the book.
You know, it's interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's interesting when you talk about the Scott Petersons of the world. I want to get your comments on the fascination with the killer dads like Scott Peterson, with some women who fall in love with them, eventually marry them, and idolize them. What kind of sick, twisted stuff is that?
Well, it's interesting. I'm actually working on something now, a freelance piece about why we love psychopaths. And some experts believe that they are predators, and they're actually equipped with certain aspects of their personality that make them very appealing. They seem to know what to give people to make them feel good about themselves. They tend to be, oddly enough, prettier or handsomer than the average human, or they know how to present themselves in that way. They're actually very charismatic. That's the way they lure in their prey. And that, if you read the book, you know that that's my theory about Scott Peterson, that he was a psychopath, and he had all the sort of romantic trappings of a great lover, but really no real emotion and no real compassion, no real love in his heart.
Yeah, and there's many cases like that, Ted Bundy, for example, and others. One of the fascinating sections of the book, and again, Killer Dads, is the case of Josh and Susan Powell, a story that we covered many times on this show with many different guests. Let's talk about your interpretation of that case.
Well, it's interesting. There's many family annihilations. There's many more murder-suicides right now. There's an increasing number in America, and a large number of those are murder-suicides of families, family annihilations. Some family annihilations, the man is sort of straight as an arrow, a pillar of society, and it's a total shock when they turn violent and kill their families and themselves. Josh came from another type of family annihilator, which is someone who does become abusive and is violent, controlling. So he was the example of that. Although it was unusual, his wife disappeared first, presumed murdered by him, and then he later, almost 2 years later, killed his sons and himself by torching a home he was in that he had booby-trapped with tanks of gasoline. And now his Susan's parents are on a hunt for her remains. They've never been found.
Right.
And the police recently closed the case, and they've released all their files, so her parents have a lot more information to go on. And they've hired a detective, and they're asking for help from the public for any tips they might have if they saw Josh and Susan traveling. They now believe she may have been killed somewhere on the highway from around Salt Lake City to Washington State.
The old saying that the nut doesn't fall far from the tree, Josh Powell's father was a sick, twisted SOB. Let's talk about him a little bit.
Well, he was arrested for taking pictures of the two little girls who lived next door, and it turned out he had, when they searched his home, they found I don't know, possibly hundreds of pictures of his daughter-in-law, Susan. He apparently had a huge crush on her and believed that it was reciprocated, which it wasn't. I don't want to go into the details there in the book, but it's pretty shocking. And I think when he went to court, Susan's parents hope that he might try to plea bargain his way out by turning over any information he might have about Susan's disappearance, which he has not. Now I understand they're having a hard time finding where to move him when he leaves prison because there's so many restrictions on people with his kind of background. They can't live near schools or any place where, near playgrounds or parks where children might congregate.
Mary Papenfuss is here. We're talking about the new book, Killer Dads. Just click on the link in the show notes or go to Amazon or your local bookstore to get a copy. Honor killings. Those are ones that, you know, it's hard to figure out any killing when you sit back and watch and, you know, the Joe and Mary six packs of the world when they're watching these stories. They figure that, gee, I'm glad this isn't happening in my family. But then when we hear about honor killings, those ones really make you scratch your head. Let's, without giving it away too much, because we want people to buy the book, let's talk about the section on honor killings.
Well, there have been cases in America and also Canada. I mean, honestly, my feeling is that honor killings could actually refer to other... There are many cases where guys, sometimes they kill their children to punish their wives when they leave them.
Right.
And, you know, whether they're, despite their religious background, I mean, one could say that's kind of an honor killing. It's a slight against their... it's a slight against their manhood, and that turns very violent. The ones I talk about in the book concern daughters who were killed because they were had a boyfriend, or they were dressing in a way that the father found inappropriate. I don't know. Go figure, men. You know what? That's why I wrote the book. I tried to solve the puzzle of murderous men. I don't know how far I got, but...
Well, you know, I think you did a good job. Again, Blog Critics has an excellent review of the book. We've posted it in the show notes. What's next for you, Mary?
You know, I don't want to give my book idea away, but I am thinking about something. It's another thing about sort of gender roles and how they affect society. I'm kind of hooked on this aspect. I was telling a friend of mine that, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and I honestly believe there was no difference between men and women other than physical at one point in my life, and that we were so contaminated by society it was difficult to say. But at this time in my life, decades later, I believe that men and women are almost different species. So that those differences are endlessly fascinating to me.
The book is Killer Dads, The Twisted Drives That Compel Fathers to Murder Their Own Kids. Mary Papenfuss, thank you, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Mary Papenfuss, kind enough to call in from Paris, France, believe it or not. And I'll hold up the book for those watching on Channel 7. You can pick up this book at your local book retailer, or at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever you do your book shopping. It's the Twisted Drives That Compel Fathers to Murder Their Own Kids. And it talks about Scott Peterson, the Powell case, and many, many others. Susan Powell was a victim of Josh, and it's just a sad case. We covered that lots here. And the author, Mary Papenfuss, a longtime investigative reporter for the New York Daily News and others, and she's written a fantastic book here. I apologize for the telephone problems tonight with Robin Sachs. It seems like that happens sometimes in live radio, but the folks at Scared Monkeys and Access will fix that little blip. But it was good to hear from Joel and Robin about the ineffective counsel issue. So that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.